Thanks very much, Matt. Those are kind words, and thanks for inviting me here. And I hope to convey to you what PGS is all about, where it came from, take you inside the code a little bit. But as Matt said, by all means, stop me and interrupt me at any point. I have about 40 slides. Some of them will go quickly. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have now or later on the program. So PGS4 is not the LHC Olympics, but certainly the LHC Olympics is the biggest customer of this code, for sure. Or client, I don't know if I'll say it that way. So definitely the efforts that I'm going to make are mainly for the LHC Olympics. I'll take you through basic ideas about detector effects and simulation. Claudio did a nice job of a lot of that already this morning, and the LHC detectors. Then the design of PGS, and a lot of detail about the physics object reconstruction in PGS, so you understand what it does and what it doesn't do. A little bit about triggers, future development. So, firstly, though I was the progenitor of this project, PGS is the work of a lot of people, many of whom contributed years ago, 8 years ago when the thing first came into being, and then more recently people from the Olympics, Aaron, Jesse, Natalia, Chris Tully, have contributed actual code to this. And of course I want to thank all of you for furthering the use and development of this package in this context. So it's, I think, a really nice tool to allow us to understand, just sort of at a crude level, the effect of that the detectors have on the physics, and you know, it gives you a feeling for the sort of foggy glass through which we view what's actually going on in the LHC. So ideally, if you're going to design a high energy physics detector, it would tell you all the four momenta of the outgoing particles in the hard collision. This is what you want to know. So here we have a vector boson fusion event, which gives us a forward and backward D and D bar quark, and then the Higgs decays to a pair of taus in the middle. This is what I hope to discover at the LHC as soon as we can get our hands on some real data. And that's what you'd like your detector to tell you. Which way did they go and how much energy did they have? But in fact, what we get is something that looks like this. And so to go from this to this is the real trick. Now we do it in a kind of an inverse way. We start with this and simulate a lot of these and then figure out techniques for trying to get back to what we actually want to know. So when you simulate your detector, there are a lot of goals for what it can tell you about the event. Firstly, you want to know the detector acceptance. We don't have 100% of 4π coverage giving us perfect resolution on everything. There are gaps in the coverage. There are places where the detector is and where it isn't. So we generally term that acceptance. The acceptance of the LHC detectors is much better than the acceptance, let's say, of the Tevatron detectors. Like, for example, CDF has this big crack right at 90 degrees. There's no coverage for the calorimeter at all. It's, you know, several centimeters thick where the two ends of the detector, you know, meet. Detector efficiency is not 100%. And the inefficiencies can occur for various reasons. For example, for tracking, you can have many tracks on top of each other. There can be hit confusion, or there can be simple, there wasn't enough charge in that cell to give you a hit. And you might lose tracks. Tracking detectors are highly efficient now. Our muon chambers are highly redundant and highly efficient. More important is perhaps detector resolution effects. When we measure the trajectory of a charged particle, we get the momentum from the sigitta, from its radius of curvature in the magnetic field. And we don't measure that perfectly. And the straighter the track is, the harder it is to measure the momentum. That's opposite the effect that you get in a calorimeter. For example, for the electromagnetic calorimeter in both CMS and ATLAS, as you get up to higher and higher energies, your relative precision on the energy measurement gets better and better. So those effects need to be simulated, and they can have a fairly big impact on what happens in trying to reconstruct the primary products of the collision. Then our detector is made of matter. And so the matter causes nuclear interactions. Pions can hit a nucleus and charge exchange, or blow the nucleus apart and get secondary hadrons coming out. Bremsstrahlung is a big effect for electromagnetically interacting particles like electrons. Pair production as well from photons. Multiple scattering can limit resolution. We kind of have this in there. These are not in the simulation I'm going to talk about, as you'll see. Then there's the effect of multiple interactions, not to be confused with multiple scattering, but multiple interactions where you have several proton-proton collisions in the same 25 nanosecond crossing. We do have a way to separate those. If they produce tracks, then we can eliminate the tracks that come from a vertex, which isn't the one that we're interested in. But for neutrals, like pi zeros, we have no way to distinguish them from which vertex they came from, so we just have to eat them. And at the LHC, this is a big effect, much bigger than at the Tevatron in run 2 even. And then there are what you might call event reconstruction effects, the idea that whatever we do to reconstruct electrons or photons or taus, we have some algorithm, we have some procedure that we go through. And this procedure can affect how good our efficiency is for reconstructing those objects and how accurately we reconstruct them and how often we get fakes. Claudia already spoke about jets faking electrons and photons and so forth and showed you that this is a serious consideration. So this sort of thing is definitely a goal of what you might want from your detector simulation. I think my battery on this thing is going. So generically, high-energy physics collider detectors have evolved to a pretty common form where you have your event happening in the middle. The beam is in perpendicular to the plane of the page, obviously, in this diagram. You have some tracking volume, which tells you the trajectory of a charged particle, like a muon here. Then there can be, for example, a solenoid producing the magnetic field that you need, and then two layers of calorimetry for electromagnetic and hadronic. In fact, in the case of CMS, the coil is on the outside of both the electromagnetic and hadronic calorimeters. It's a really nice design, something we've wanted to do as high-energy physicists for many years, and now we've achieved it. And outside of that, you have some system for identifying muons, which are the only things that can penetrate all the steel and lead and what have you in the calorimeter system. So a muon is a track penetrating the calorimeter, giving you a hit in the muon chambers. A photon is no track, just a dotted line there, and then deposits its energy in the EM calorimeter. An electron looks pretty much just like a photon, except it has a track pointing at it. A single pion, for example, from a tau, would penetrate the electromagnetic calorimeter, not always, but mostly give you its energy in the hadronic calorimeter. And mostly what we'll see at the LHC, as we do at the Tevatron, are jets, quark and gluon jets, which give you a mixture of photons from pi zero decay and then charged pions and kaons, which give you hadronic energy. And so you get this collimated cluster of tracks and neutral electromagnetic energy. So here's a picture of the Atlas detector. Oh, sorry. That's actually a V8 engine. Here's the Atlas detector, which remarkably looks like a V8 engine in cutaway view until you realize that those are two human beings standing there. It's an absolutely... that's what keeps it going. Looks like a big, you know, fan. But this detector... is very much in line with the generic sort of high-energy collider detector that I just showed you, with tracking on the inside, calorimetry, let's find the solenoid is here. So it's between the tracking and the calorimetry. And then hadronic calorimetry, and then muon chambers on the outside. The unique thing about Atlas is it has these large toroidal magnets here, which look like giant air ducts or something. but there's actually a magnetic field produced that is going around azimuthally the detector, so that when a muon comes out, it bends one way due to the axial field due to the solenoid. So it bends in the sort of R5 view, I guess you'd call it, and then it bends in the Z direction as it goes through the magnetic field out here. So there are muon chambers embedded in the magnetic field region that track the particle through there. So there's a big emphasis, a huge amount of the real estate of ATLAS is devoted to muons, as you can see. Now on the very inside, I'm going to go back a second, whoops. On the very inside is a tracking detector which is based on silicon pixels in the very middle, surrounded by silicon strips, surrounded by a transition radiation tracker, which is really a gas-based detector. ATLAS hedged their bets a little bit and put in the TRT rather than the all-silicon approach that CMS took, because there's some worry still that the intense radiation environment over many years could damage the silicon to the point where it's really unusable. And so the transition radiation tracker with gas flowing through it is immune from such radiation damage. So let's go to CMS. The CMS experiment, the difference people like to say between CMS and ATLAS is that if you took ATLAS and you wrapped it in plastic, it would float. But if you take CMS and you wrap it in plastic, it would definitely sink. It's very dense. It's got an all-silicon tracker on the inside, electromagnetic calorimeter based on lead tungstate crystals, all pointing at the interaction region, and then a brass scintillator, hadronic calorimeter surrounding that. And then again, a large amount of the real estate in volume is devoted to muon chambers, which are interleaved with these big steel plates, which form the return path for the magnetic field lines here. So in CMS, a muon will have a curved trajectory. Here's the solenoid, by the way, is outside the calorimeter and tracker. A muon will get curved by the magnetic field there. It'll curve the other way as it goes through the muon chambers on the outside. Total weight of this detector is actually similar to that of the ATLAS detector. I used to go around saying that these were battleship-sized detectors, but that's not accurate. A battleship is about 30,000 tons, and these are about 12,500 tons, or this one says 14,500, which puts them in the destroyer class, which sounds cooler anyway. So if you compare them side by side, then they've taken, CMS and ATLAS have taken very similar but slightly different approaches to solving the LHC problem. Both have silicon pixels on the innermost, as the innermost device in the tracker, and then silicon strips, though ATLAS has in addition these gas transition radiation chambers outside of those as sort of insurance. For the electromagnetic calorimeter, ATLAS has chosen cryogenic liquid argon, and CMS has chosen lead tungstate. They end up having very similar performance in terms of resolution, which makes our job easier here, because then we can just put in a sort of generic thing representing a kind of average of CMS and ATLAS. Likewise, for the hadronic calorimeter, the best approach is still to use this layered sort of thing. CMS is made out of brass, since you need a non-magnetic material. ATLAS has steel and scintillator. And then on the outside, there's a combination of resistive plate chambers and scintillators and drift chambers for muon identification and for triggering. So in some sense, they're very similar. They're slightly different. We'll see in the long run how well they both work. I think we're going to get great physics out of both approaches. Now, the gold standard in high-energy physics for simulating high-energy collisions with these complex detectors is the JANT program, and JANT 4 is what both experiments are using right now. It represents, you know, decades of work of people all around the world contributing to understanding how particles interact with the material of the detector. And it treats the detector as slabs of a particular material. There's steel, there's carbon, there's whatever, you know, gas you want or something, and it simulates in really exquisite detail all the energy depositions from ionization as charged particles pass through, from hadronic and electromagnetic showers happening in the material. Simulates all the secondary interactions and, you know, does a fantastic job, but it takes many minutes of CPU time per event. And that's a limitation for trying to do fast simulation of the type that we'd like to do for the LHC Olympics. So let me talk about PGS. The idea is to provide a fast simulation, which is a sort of standard interface to the various event generators like Pythia, Herwig, IsaJet, AlpGen, and in fact there are many more that are potentially interfaceable with PGS, because PGS is based on something called the STD-HEP standard. It uses as an internal representation of the event the so-called STD-HEP common blocks, which essentially just a list of all the generated particles in the event, both the initial but then the final state ones that actually hit the detector. And then PGS wants to perform a very basic detector simulation with tracks. In other words, charged particles leave tracks, so put in tracks. Charged particles and neutrals hit the calorimeter, leave energy deposits in the calorimeter. We simulate that. And we simulate muon identification. The final aim is to give the user a list of physics objects, photons, electrons, muons, taus, jets, including B-jet tagging, and missing transverse energy, just based on the tracks and calorimeter energy deposits which are simulated here. And we put in some parameterizations where we need to and where sensible. So it doesn't try to do everything, but it tries to do a basic, you know, representation of what happens in one of these events. So how does it do relative to our goals for a perfect simulation? Well, does it get a detector acceptance? Yes. We have the range of coverage of the detectors represented fairly well in there. What about efficiency? Yes. I think we do that quite well in PGS. Resolution? Yes. Where we don't in PGS have good simulation is in things like the secondary interactions. No to nuclear, no to Bremsstrong, no pair production, no multiple scattering in the detector. However, we do have resolution for the tracks represented. So in the sense that multiple scattering mainly affects your momentum resolution, that is represented. So I should maybe put a yes in there, because where it's important, we do cover it. For multiple interactions, no, there's no pileup. This would be possible to do. All you would have to do is generate another, let's say, Pythia event and keep the list of underlying, or not an underlying event, but the sort of minimum bias particles on top of it. This is something that someone could work on and perhaps implement without too much difficulty. Yes? I think that's a fair statement. Yes, that both pair production and Bremsstrahlung will be repaired for photons and electrons respectively in both experiments. Yes, and to what level? Well, I don't know. We're assuming it's essentially perfect by the method that we have here. The other thing that I didn't mention here: we don't have any magnetic field effects. The magnetic field, for example, in CMS is 4 Tesla. That tends to curl up a lot of the soft particles. Now, for us, in PGS, a soft particle, let's say a 200 MeV pion coming out, will make a 200 MeV energy deposit in some calorimeter cell. So that's not realistic either. And that's something I'm actually kind of worried about lately, as you'll see as we go on in discussing this. We might want to cut off low-energy particles, for example. We haven't done that yet, so I have to think hard about these sorts of things. They would never hit the calorimeter. A 1 GeV particle will not hit the calorimeter in CMS. But I don't know the exact number, but it's around a GeV that you need to hit the calorimeter. Sure. No, we have a very idealized calorimeter, which is just segmented in rapidity, pseudorapidity, and azimuth in some into cells. And event reconstruction effects are simulated in PGS in the sense that to make these physics objects that we want, I actually use the list of tracks and calorimeter deposits to do so, as you'll see. So Matt alluded to this in introducing me, but this program started back in 1998 when we kicked off the Tevatron Run 2 Susie Higgs workshop, the aim of which was to... It was one of several workshops. There was a TOP workshop, there was a QCD one, B-Physics. But the Susie Higgs workshop was the first one. The aim was to reevaluate things like the Tevatron reach and run two for the standard model Higgs and MSSM Higgs and various Susie processes. At that point, we didn't have any run two detector, CDF, or D0 simulation programs. The other thing was it was a lot of CDF people and D0 people working together with theorists, and so we needed some sort of neutral ground and some common tool to use to simulate this stuff. So we developed this SHW simulation to represent an average of CDF and D0. And as I'm sure many of you know, by late 2000, October of 2000, we published the Susie Higgs Workshop Higgs Report. And if you've ever seen this plot, possibly one of the most well-known plots in high-energy physics, I was the author of this thing because I worked on the Susie Higgs workshop, and we combined all of the different channels that we had for standard model Higgs and put it together into what became the standard way to represent the standard model Higgs reach at the Tevatron. It's still a good reference for standard model Higgs, in fact. And, we redid the study in 2003, and the results weren't very different from what we got then. And, in fact, now we're approaching the curves that look very much like that in the real detector, but I won't show you that. Now, for SNOMASS 2001, when we were trying as a community to develop a consensus for building the linear collider, SHW morphed into something called PGS, the pretty good simulation, and put it out with other simulation packages that people could use at SNOMASS during the workshop to simulate things. And a number of people did that, used it for the VLHC, LHC, and also linear collider studies, comparing with Tevatron and so forth. The theorists, though, at SNOMASS 01 seemed to latch onto this program more than the experimentalists, because of the limitations that I've already described in PGS, which, you know, at the stage that you are at a place like SNOMASS 01, where you're trying to see which kind of detector do you want to build for the future linear collider, you want something that's going to simulate detector effects much better than that. It wasn't so much about comparing different physics models, about comparing different, you know, approaches to the linear collider detectors. So what PGS ends up being good for, though, is kind of what I might call prototyping and analysis. Taking a physics idea you might have and seeing, is there any hope of getting enough acceptance or detector resolution or some of the, you know, basic quantities to see, is it possible to see this new physics signal at all, or am I just crazy? If it doesn't work in PGS, it probably won't work in a much more complicated and full detector simulation. So the way PGS works is to start with your favorite event generator, Pythia or Herwig or one of these, and that gives you the event that you want to represent in the STD-HEP common blocks. PGS's main thing then is to perform the event simulation and physics object reconstruction and then make that data available to the user in his or her analysis. And then the user can put out their output in whatever form they wish, an end tuple, histograms, a list of events, an event display, however you want to do it. So the user provides code at this point to do whatever it is they want. PGS, the main bit, is really all contained in the middle box here. The way the detector simulation works is to go through this STD-HEP list of all the final state particles, and then, if it's a charged particle, put it in the list of charged tracks with some efficiency, which you can set in a parameter file. The tracks are straight in the sense that whichever way they're headed from the origin, from the primary interaction vertex, that's where they're going to hit the detector ultimately. And then we simulate calorimeter deposits in this idealized, you can think of this backdrop here as the calorimeter unrolled, if you want. Each one of these little cells represents a calorimeter cell. And indeed, in the LHC simulation that we're doing now, we have something like 320 cells in rapidity and 100 in azimuth, something like that. So it's like pi over 100, or 0.03 radians, 0.0314 radians, which is very close to the segmentation of the calorimeter in CMS and Atlas. And it's much smaller than the segmentation that we've been working with in the CDF and D0 detectors. So this charged particle or a neutral particle hits some cell, one cell. So whichever cell it lies in, all its energy goes into that cell. Now that's another limitation of this program. Real electromagnetic showers are several centimeters wide, and so tend to hit one or two cells. Hadronic showers are many cells wide, and the hadronic calorimeter segmentation is about three times the size of the electromagnetic calorimeter simulation segmentation in the CMS and Atlas detectors. So, however, that is not represented in PGS presently. The EM and hadronic calorimeter tower sizes are required to be the same. That's built into the program the way it is now. So that's one place in which PGS is not realistic, in that is that it has much more finely segmented hadronic calorimeter than the real detectors, but then also the showers in the real detectors are spread out over many cells. So it's doubly bad in some sense. As a representation of what's happening in the LHC detectors. A muon, since it's just minimum ionizing, will deposit some energy in the calorimeter, about 1.5 or 2 GeV in the electromagnetic section, for example, and then pass through and hit the muon chambers with some efficiency that's defined in the program. The resolution of the hadronic and electromagnetic section of the calorimeter is a user-controllable parameter, as is the resolution on charged tracks, as you'll see in a second. So these plots, which are from the original SHW program user guide, which is provided along with the PGS code, show you how the different kinds of particles interact in the calorimeter. Yes? That's okay. Right. For example. So for jets, this probably isn't a big deal. Probably not, you know, worth worrying about too much. You have a dense jet hitting a lot of cells. Well, that's pretty much what you'll see anyway in a real detector jet. Pardon me? I'm standing here thinking about that myself right now. Why might this be an issue? So we'll put that question on hold for our discussions later, unless I come up with something. Yes? No. Except in the sense that we assume that the hadronic calorimeter is behind the electromagnetic calorimeter. If you look at electrons, for example, and look at the generated energy of the electron from 0 up to 200 here, and then the energy that's put into the cell that it hits. It's a 1-to-1 ratio like that with some spread around it due to the resolution. And then there's some crack fraction that is set, and sometimes you get zero energy from the electron because it's gone in a crack. Now, that was a much more important effect for CDF and D0, and this represents that. But that crack fraction is a controllable parameter. I've set it to nearly zero in PGS for the LHC Olympics parameter files. On the other hand, an electron, and there's a very different scale here now, 0 to 200 and 0 to 10 GeV, an electron shower can leak into the hadron calorimeter, and that amount of energy is also represented in the hadronic part. So this is the electromagnetic and hadronic energy deposited by an electron in a given tower. But what about a muon? It deposits, a fraction of a GeV in the electromagnetic section, and then a 2 GeV or so in the hadronic section. I misspoke on the previous slide. It's much thicker, so there's more energy deposited in the hadronic calorimeter. Single pions ideally would put all of their energy into the hadronic calorimeter with good resolution. Well, first of all, the resolution is poor, and second of all, pions can start to shower early in the electromagnetic section, so they tend to put a fraction of their energy into both the electromagnetic and hadronic part. And this is taken account of in the following sense, that you, as a pion hits a given tower, we pick a fraction of how much energy goes into EM and hadronic, and then subtract that from the pion's actual energy, and then put in resolution effects on top of that. It's done in a fairly reasonable way, I would say. But this is where one place where the parameterizations play a big role, is in the calorimeter deposits. So I've alluded a number of times to these parameters, user-controllable parameters. This one is the LHC parameter set. And so all the numbers are here, and then the description of what they represent is here. So for example, the eta and phi width of the calorimeter cells is pi over 100 for both EM and hadron. And as I say, the way the code's set up, that has to be the same for both. We could imagine splitting those at some point, but that would be a really big change to the code, so I don't know. 320 eta cells and 200 phi cells, 200, all the way around in 2 pi. Electromagnetic calorimeter resolution, Herman? This is, yes. We should spend some time thinking about whether these numbers make sense. Yes? .01 is a constant term. Yeah, this is wrong. This is based on a very early version of the LHC parameter file. I don't think it's what's actually in there, but we can check that. In fact, now you made me nervous. We've had enough New York Times. So let's check what's in lhc.par in the actual code that we're distributing these days. 0.2. This is not right. Okay, we're going to have to look at this because. It should be. Okay, there's. In fact, I have a different function set up for the resolution. Let me just show you the code right now, if you're interested. Oops. place where the parameters are read in. So there's a electromagnetic calorimeter resolution A and B term, which there's a constant term and a certain percent over root E, okay? And one of the new additions in going to PGS-4 was to add this. We used to just have the hadron calorimeter and electromagnetic calorimeter as single parameters, like 20% over root E represents CDF and D0 pretty well, but not the LHC. Now I'm really worried about virginitis, though, I have to confess. So we'll come back to that as a discussion. Missing ET resolution is put in here. It should be more like 1%. Look, we're going to review this carefully because, you know, I did review it carefully earlier in April when I made the change to this. Let's come back to this. So then there are parameters controlling the cluster finding algorithm, the threshold for the seed and so-called shoulder towers. There's the KT cluster finder cone size, delta R, radius of the tracker, the magnetic field, your sagitta resolution, which here is 13 microns, track finding efficiency, minimum track PT, the eta. So we have a 1 GeV threshold for finding tracks. That's good. But we really should apply such a threshold to calorimeter energy deposits as well, probably in future versions of this. Eta coverage out to 3 for tracking, electron and photon eta coverage, muon coverage slightly less, taus out to eta of 2, which is perhaps optimistic. I don't know. We'll see. The user is free to change these at his or her own risk, and we're going to review this electromagnetic calorimeter one later by actually comparing how these numbers are used in the code, because I know I went over this really carefully, so let's just... I'm second-guessing myself a lot these days, but... I don't have a plot of it that's in this talk, but it's better than a percent out at high energy, so, yeah. Hadronic 80% over square root of E is what we have in there. It's not so far from reality. Right, so the electromagnetic calorimeter resolution is supposed to be A plus B over square root of E, and we just use for hadronic calorimetry B over square root of E. For the tracking resolution, we actually take the magnetic field, the radius, and the sagitta error, and then we calculate the sagitta for a track that we would get, smear it by the sagitta error, and get the reconstructed PT and put that in as the PT of the track. That's as, I think, accurate as you can possibly do in a fast simulation. And this would, in fact, include the possibility of charge confusion for very, very straight tracks, very high energy muons, let's say, from Z prime at 1.5 TeV. You might actually find mu minus or something from events like that. I haven't looked myself, so it'd be interesting to see if anyone has seen that in this program. But that will happen, that sort of thing will happen in the real detector. So after the second LHC Olympics meeting last winter, the request was made to use the KT jet algorithm rather than the CDF jet clue like algorithm, cone algorithm that I had implemented in PGS at that point. So in the end, we ended up doing both, using these so-called top-down cone jets for the trigger object and bottom-up KT jets used for physics objects or physics jet objects. Now let me be very clear from the beginning here that the way PGS works is to take the calorimeter energy deposits. Forget about the tracks for the moment. Just look at the calorimeter. It uses these algorithms to make calorimeter clusters. And I'm calling them now trigger calorimeter clusters and physics object calorimeter clusters, okay? And it's from those that you make the physics objects, jets, electrons, taus, photons, and so forth. So those are separate lists within the PGS code. Now, it's become clear that for the next version of PGS, we're going to have to make this a user-settable switch, whether users want to use KTJets or ConeJets has become a bit of an issue within the Olympics. In the meantime, we're studying the performance of these algorithms and comparing what one gets with KTJets versus ConeJets. There's, I think, a fair bit of work that needs to be done in that regard. Back on full screen. So I call the cone algorithm top-down because what it does is it scans the whole calorimeter, looks for the tower that has the most energy in it, and calls that the seed, and then looks for other energy in a cone around it, a fixed cone size delta R naught here, and adds those other calorimeter towers to the seed tower, as long as they're above some shoulder threshold, which as you saw was like 1 GeV or something in the previous slide. So not all of the energy in the event gets put into a cone jet. Whereas with KTJet, all the energy gets clustered because it's sort of a bottom-up thing. It treats all the towers, and we take electromagnetic from plus hadronic as the measure of that, as particles. And each particle-particle distance is calculated as the minimum of KT squared for particle I and particle J, so whichever one is smaller, times the delta R separation of the two particles. And then we divide by this delta R zero squared to give it a maximum cone size. And you compare that with the particle beam distances, so-called, in quotes, because you just use KT I squared, or KTJ squared, whichever one is minimum. If the overall minimum is one of these, you merge them together, change your list of particles, and then repeat the process until no mergeable pairs remain. So when you're all done, you have a list of things which, when you compare their distances with each other, they're bigger than the distance to the beam in some sense with KT squared. So, interesting algorithm. I coded it from scratch back in March based on this paper that I found from last year. One of the problems of the KTJet algorithm in the experimental community has been that when you think about the number of operations you need to go through to actually perform this algorithm, it goes like n cubed, where n is the number of particles that you start with, and which in this case would be the number of towers which have energy deposits in them. This one scales more like n log n. And so for very finely segmented calorimeter, large number of towers, this one can take a lot more time. But these authors, and I could show you the paper, came up with some clever tricks to avoid that sort of scaling, changing your lists on the fly and so forth, and prove that they could get n log n behavior. So that's what I implemented. And it took a fair bit of programming and coding, leaving one tiny bug at the end, which was uncovered 10 days ago. You'll see that in a little bit. So now the two algorithms differ, I think, mainly in the tails of various distributions. KT gets you all the energy above some threshold. That may or may not be a desirable quality for it to have. No matter what, when you have funny-shaped jets, for example, a quark jet with a gluon jet on the side of it, it's always going to be a difficulty. Does that extra energy on the side go with the jet, or do you split it off? And I don't think the community, or the field as a whole, has an answer to this question. A question I've been raising lately in my own talks and which I've been studying in my own work is whether delta R is even the right measure of separation for particles, combining them or not combining them. The main justification for using delta R, which as you know is delta eta squared plus delta phi squared, square root of that, is that it's Z boost invariant. We don't know the center of mass of the hard collision we're interested in. And we would like that what algorithm we use is kind of invariant under a longitudinal boost. And indeed, an interval in delta R remains constant when you boost an event let's say, forward. That's great. The other reason that people give for using delta R is that the number of underlying event particles per unit rapidity is roughly constant as a function of eta. So when you're trying to, if you're worried about picking up extra energy by using delta R, you will always have the same amount of extra energy getting into your jet or whatever, independent of the azimuth or the azimuthal angle, not azimuthal, but the longitudinal angle, polar angle. But my claim is the following, that jets of a given energy have the same shape in space at any pseudo-rapidity. Now let me be a little provocative. Here is a sphere. Eta equals zero is the equator, so you can imagine the beam axis is something like that. And here I've included on the sphere points that lie within delta R of 0.4 of this point here at eta equals 1, this point here at eta equals 2, and so forth. Now, you don't think about this too much, but in 3D space, the solid angle subtended by a delta R cone of 0.4 at eta equals 0 is much larger, more than a factor of 2 larger than the corresponding 3D sort of angle subtended by a delta R cone of 0.4 at eta equals 1. And it's even smaller. So it's like if this is 1, this is 0.45 in solid angle, and this is 0.15 in solid angle, and it gets much smaller at eta equals 3. So phi is pinching it down, and the fact that eta pinches down at as you get closer to the beam axis gives you this big geometrical effect. So the question I raise is, if you have a 100 GeV jet, it's going to have the same size at eta equals 0 and at eta equals 1, but we're demanding that it go into a smaller hole at eta equals 1, and at eta equals 2 it gets worse. Now that's 100 GeV energy. The flip side, the other point of view is, well, what about ET? If you have a 100 GeV ET jet and it's boosted, yeah, it will have then 200 and something GeV at eta equals 1, so it will fit in there. And if it gets boosted even more, it will fit into there. But what's the right thing to do? What is it we're trying to accomplish by our jet reconstruction algorithms? We're using a sort of a one delta R size fits all approach to reconstructing jets, which are very different. As you go to very high energy, at eta equals 0, you're going to have a very small jet. Presumably, most of the energy is going to be in a much tighter cone than it would for a 50 GeV jet. So what I'm trying to raise, at least in people's consciousness these days, is whether or not using a fixed delta R cone size for reconstructing all jets makes good physics sense. Claudia? At a fixed ET, that's true. That's right, but why is that more important than energy? We're trying to measure four momentum, after all, and energy is one of the four quantities in four momentum. So. It might be, though, that if we allowed jets to have energy-dependent cone size, we would more properly split jets apart that should be split apart in the central region, and we might merge jets in the forward regions that should be merged. This is something that I'm just raising at this point. I don't have an answer, and I don't have an algorithm which would give you an energy-dependent delta R code. We're going to much higher eta now with this, the LHC detectors, and the jets tend to be more forward too, so.
The argument that they are strong, there are questions about whether experimentally, given the process now of merging and then the problem with the process, it's not entirely obvious. The argument that we're given in terms of maybe being
The other thing, the other thing that you can see here is that for the cone at 80 equals 1, the cone isn't really even centered on the direction that you're interested in. I don't know what effect that tends to have. It means you favor particles on the lower eta side going into your jet, but you disfavor ones at higher eta. And I don't know if there's a good physics argument for that. It means you're going to bias, when you're all done, your jet form momentum is going to be biased toward the central region a little bit. I don't know what effect that has on our physics. Yes? Michael? Oftentimes, yeah. That's very true. Very true. In terms of the CMS detector, the NCAP electromagnetic calorimeter, you can only go so small in the size of these crystals before, you know, you can't do it any longer. And so I haven't actually reviewed what the geometry looks like for CMS as you get to like 2.5 or 3 in eta, but I'm betting that you don't go below about 2 centimeters in the size of the crystals. So that means they're subtending a bigger eta phi region in the forward direction. Not in CMS? You mean like beyond the crystals? Sorry, I have to take a mulligan on that one. So let me go through the different PGS objects and how they're reconstructed. In real life, as I said before, the electromagnetic showers are narrow. The Mollier radius is about a centimeter on that order. And hadronic showers are wide, many centimeters. And there's no lateral spread in PGS, just hits a single tower. So to reconstruct electrons and photons, we rely on the fact, of course, that the energy is deposited in the electromagnetic section. So we start with clusters, in this case coming from the KT jet algorithm, and apply the electromagnetic fraction cuts, match it with a track. If there's no track, it's a photon candidate. If there is a track, it's an electron candidate. Then apply a 3x3 region calorimeter isolation cut, which I think I show on the next page here. You can imagine that an electron hitting deposits all its energy here. We look in a 3x3 region, like so, around the calorimeter cell that's hit to see if there's any extra energy. So if, you know, a nearby cell has some energy, this won't affect it. But if it were here, it could, you know, cause you to reclassify it. Then, though I draw it as a circle like this, we look for extra tracks within some region around the track direction. In fact, a region of 0.4 in delta R, which is roughly 23 degrees at eta equals 0. We require that the total PT be less than 5 GeV. What we're after here by requiring this isolation is to know that the electron did not come from a jet. What we're after is electrons which are isolated, which are coming from, for example, W decays or Chargino decays or something. And then 0.10% of the energy is the cut in the 3x3 collar region. In the end, this is what the electron efficiency looks like in PGS after all is said and done as a function of pseudo-rapidity. It goes out to about eta equals 3. And it's around 87% or so in the central region and fairly flat. And I think this is sort of what we'll enjoy in both CMS and ATLAS. It's not far away from the ultimate reconstruction efficiency. Right. That's something that's coded in PGS in a way that that's something that we could review and change. For example, we could include all cells within a certain delta R of the... Well, it would mean rewriting one of the subroutines, and we decided not to do that for this round. But maybe for the next round, that's something to put on the list. And I brought it up in some of our email exchanges, I think you might recall, but never did it. For taus, we have developed at CDF and D0 kind of a standard approach based on, again, a cone. In CDF, the cone is based on a seed track. Here in PGS, in fact, and I should have written this, we use a cone based on the position of the calorimeter cluster. So we loop over all clusters as the outer loop and then find tracks that are associated with that cluster in the next loop. Might consider reversing this for the next round of PGS, and taus, as you'll see in a second, are suffering a little bit from the changes in going from PGS3 to PGS4 and going from lower energy to high energy, I think. We fake the pi zero reconstruction because we use this program called tauola to decay the taus. And this is an important thing. Pythia, for example, doesn't represent the decay phase space of taus very well at all. And so we have to use this secondary program that which comes through and decays the taus for you. Now, it produces lists of pi zeros which are undecayed, so we treat pi zeros as if they're photons, which is kind of inaccurate as well, because low-energy pi zeros, the two photons can spread. But we don't include that, and just assume that CMS and Atlas will be able to do that. One of the things that we hit upon for run 2 in CDF is that due to simple relativistic kinematics, as the visible energy of the tau decay products gets bigger, they're constrained to a tighter and tighter cone. So we use this shrinking cone idea in PGS as well. That was one of the changes in going from PGS3 to PGS4. And that buys us a lot of jet to tau fake rate reduction in the end. Certainly it does in CDF, we're using it. And so I'm pretty sure that we'll use this in the LHC experiments as well, though we're presently rewriting the tau reconstruction. Now, ouch, the tau efficiency is down no more than 40% at eta equals zero and falls off rapidly before eta equals two. So I've been wanting to study this for a while and finally found some time yesterday afternoon in my hotel room to look into why is this happening. It used to be higher when we were looking at PGS for CDF and D0 before. Yes? This is MSSM Higgs to tau tau. Not too many. It's pretty clean. So if you look at the pseudo, first of all, we had that hard limit at eta equals two you saw in the parameter file. So here's the generated distribution. Then requiring one or three tracks gives you the light blue. Adding a mass cut and an anti-electron cut brings you to this, but it's the isolation cut is really killing us here. Now that kind of tends to suggest to me, and I haven't verified this, that in going to higher energy in these LHC events, there's a lot of underlying event particles which are getting into the isolation cone more than I was used to looking at Tevatron style energies. So it could, I'm going to have to verify this, and the tau reconstruction in PGS is going to get a major overhaul in the coming months or weeks. I should say. Better not be months, right? So this is a place where a good deal of work is needed. Yes? Presumably. Yeah. And as we talked about earlier in Claudia's talk, we weren't here, but there's a factor of two uncertainty at least in that these days, so for sure. I don't know whether it's being over or underestimated or which end of the factor of two Pythia has right now, but okay. So, well, hopefully that might do it. Putting in a threshold on the isolation might help. We'll just have to look at various possibilities. Anyway, taus aren't doing too well in PGS at the moment, but they might not do too well in the first year or two of LHC either. So as you saw, both experiments really emphasize muon ID and reconstruction, and all the layers of chambers and so forth in CMS here. We just provide a parameterized efficiency, but we don't apply it by default in PGS. It's basically 100% efficient for muons in PGS within a certain eta range. It's equal to the tracking efficiency. So we just leave that to the user. So this kind of illustrates. I'll go back. What you kind of summarizes nicely. A single pion does that. A single electron deposits its energy there. A muon will be in PGS a straight track, doing essentially that. So it's not so far from reality. Here's the muon efficiency as a function of pseudorapidity out to about 2.4, I think we said in the parameter file. E-tagging is something that also got an upgrade in going from PGS 3 to 4. Jason Nielsen from CDF, who has just moved to Santa Cruz now, provided these B-tagging functions from the CDF experiment. They're parametrized curves that kind of represent what we see. But the efficiency is a function of jet ET for bees. It tops out around 48%, something like that, for the tight B tagging. Charm jets pass the B tag with about 10% efficiency. They have a shorter lifetime. And then light quarks and gluons have a very small, basically less than a percent or so, probability of becoming tagged or being tagged. Here it is as a function of pseudorapidity as well. I should warn you that if you ever try to run PGS outside of the pseudorapidity range of 2, these are polynomials and they come back up like that. So someone already found that, and I told them by email what was going on. Now, we can put in hard cuts that prevent that sort of behavior. They have these funny little lobes as well. Okay. This is probably not too far from the eventual LHC experience. They still have fantasies in CMS and Atlas of getting up to 60 or 70% B-tagging efficiency. The trick is to do that and have your 1% jet-to-B fake rate. So we'll see how that flies. I don't think it'll be too much easier to tag B-jets in the LHC experiments than it is in CDF and D0. Let me make a note about uniqueness, something that I've tried to get PGS users to do for years. I'm not sure what was done in the implementation of PGS for the LHC Olympics 1 and 2, the program that Steve Mrenna used. He was using a version of uniqueness, but I don't think it's exactly the same. The thing is, PGS makes a list of all the physics objects. Now, given energy deposit, could be simultaneously give rise to an electron, a tau, and a jet. In the list of PGS objects, all three of those will be present. So then you have to decide which one is the real one. Well, if it passes all the electron cuts, we say it's an electron. But if it fails the electron cuts but passes the tau cuts, it's a tau, etc. There's an order precedence. So we have to have an algorithm to decide what these things are. Can't call it two different things. You can't use the same energy deposit, the same object, as two different. It can't be both an electron and a jet when you actually go and do whatever physics you want to do. We run into this problem at the Tevatron all the time, too. So there's a physics object precedence order. Photon is greater than electron, is greater than tau, is greater than jet. So as I said, if it's already identified as an electron, it can't be a tau or a jet. Likewise, if it's identified as a tau, it cannot be a jet. That makes the jet the catch-all class. So if resolution effects or whatever make you fail the electron cuts, the electron can be a jet. Some of your jets will look a lot like electrons because that's what they came from. This happens in real life too. So when I say reconstruction effects, this is one of them that can happen in PGS. Muons are all unique because they penetrate all that steel and lead and whatever. We identify them, 100% efficiency. They are unique no matter what, even if they're buried in a jet. And that led to a bit of a difficulty with getting PGS-4 off the ground. Now, uniqueness, you see, an electron might be reconstructed in a slightly different direction from a jet, because the jet is based on the whole calorimeter deposit. The electron direction is based on the track that that you call the electron. So anyway, we have a 10-degree cut. Unique objects have to be at least 10 degrees apart. That's a hard-coded thing. Maybe there's a better algorithm you could think of to do it. I'm all ears. Now, this object uniqueness is enforced in the following sense. There's a unique flag for each object, which you should be cutting on when you use it. Yes? Uh-huh. 10 degrees in space, yeah. So what happens at high rapidity, I Jets are a catch-all in the sense that they stay there. They stay listed as jets and get the unique flag set no matter what. As long as there's no electron or tau on top of it, you're okay. Yeah. Right. We don't do any object merging. So they remain separate jets at high rapidity. So in deciding which object wins the battle of uniqueness, I have to have pairs of objects. And the pairs are any objects within 10 degrees of each other. Okay, so...
I have a singular object, I have multiple possible identifications for.
Mm-hmm. Well, gamma versus E won't be a problem typically, but... E versus tau.
Is that what you mean? It's like I have a tau possibility,
so very slightly, typically. 10 degrees is generous on this.
So when you say pairs of objects, pairs of possible objects.
That came from the same... Right. Did they come from the same energy deposit is the question. Yeah. I could actually use the cluster index rather than the 10 degree thing. That might be a better approach. Go ahead. Not if they're two jets. Jet and a tau. Yeah. Yeah. They have to be different assignments. Yeah. Remember, our tracking only goes out to 8 of 3. So you don't have any electrons beyond 8 of 3. So we're talking, let's say, between 2.5 and 3. In reality, or what? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think, in fact, that happens. We call EM-only clusters out beyond 8 of 3 photons. They end up in the photon list. There's no cut on energy. So I don't think what you're describing can happen, but I'm trying to imagine if it could. Maybe we'll can we draw the situation on a piece of paper later, cuz I'm yeah. Okay, so let's talk about how PGS was used in the LHC Olympics. The goal here was to simulate the look and feel, the experience of analyzing physics results for new unknown physics. And you're getting a good introduction to experimental realities of various sorts, maybe not all just new physics. So we wanted a fast, even if rudimentary simulation, and PGS fit the bill. So last year, an ASCII file output format was created to store the unique physics object list with eta, phi, pt, and other information about each object. And now for this third Olympics, the file format was extended slightly to include muon isolation, that is, to require that muons be away from jets and other energy deposits, and trigger information. I'll talk about that in a minute. Also, the PGS distribution is better packaged, more reliable, uses make, doesn't use CERNLIB, so forth, and that's been a big improvement, thanks to Jesse and Aaron and Natalia. So, PGS gives us these trigger objects with very loose, simple cuts. But the bottom line here is these are not the objects used for triggering in the LHC Olympics. So you should realize that PGS provides a list of trigger objects, but they're not used in the LHC Olympics. Why? Is because Herman and Chris Tully, who wrote the code for the LHC-like trigger table, decided that it would be better to use physics object-like things, which is what's used in the high-level triggers of CMS and Atlas anyway. And they persuaded me ultimately that that was the right approach. So they wrote this code, which includes triggers for single leptons or photons. In the real experiments, we have, as Claudio showed, various combinations of objects with various thresholds. And this is one of the things that I find that theorists just, they don't like it at all. Why can't I trigger on 5 GeV electrons if that's what I want to do? Well, you can't because we can't possibly record it on all the storage media in the world. So we have a very complete trigger table. It's pretty accurate. It's divided into a level 1, or low threshold, low energy threshold, and level 2, a high energy threshold version. And then this trigger word, which is a number of bits corresponding to each trigger combination, is recorded in the LHC Olympics output. So if you really want to simulate what you're doing, you'll have to require that whatever you want to simulate as background or an alternate signal passes the same triggers that you're running. Here are some example trigger thresholds which are implemented in the LHC Olympics program. For inclusive lepton, level 1 threshold is 30, 180 for the level 2. This is the thresholds this is what we record. We actually throw away a lot of these events in going to level 2. So it gives you an idea of how difficult it is at the LHC. A lepton plus a jet. You need the lepton to be 130 and the jet to be 200 GeV. 200 GeV missing energy. Lepton plus taus, 45 and 60, which is pretty good actually. Inclusive jet trigger, 1,000 at level 2. So, well, possibly have to revise that if we get tau efficiency up. So, ouch. Here's an example of the LHC output file. There's a little descriptive line at the top. Then each event has trigger words, an event number. Here's the trigger word here, I believe. I forget what this one is. I don't know. And then there's a list of objects, which gives you the type. Type 4 is jet. Type 6 is missing energy. Eta and phi, PT, etc. Some information about the quantities. Two columns reserved for future expansion, something else that we could talk about at some point. So these are ASCII files, human readable by anybody's program that they write, which is a nice way to share data, I think, even if it's inefficient. So, in the words of the Zen master Yogi Berra, if this was easy, it wouldn't be so hard. And there are bugs. Bugs are a fact of life in experiments, and they have crept into PGS as well. And so, as I've been trying to say, it's a good introduction to my world. PGS 3 to 4 transition was quite ambitious, and I had a great deal of help from Jesse and Aaron and other people running the program feeding back to me. but we did not catch all the bugs for the June release. It looked pretty good for a long time, but until 10 days ago, in fact, I didn't know of any problems with this simulation. So, you know, lots of events were generated during the summer. So Kyle Armour from Washington, who's here, on August 13th sent an email, which I got when I got on shift in the CDF control room that Saturday morning. And I spent the rest of the day monitoring the run. We had great luminosity, by the way, that whole week at the Tevatron. We recorded lots and lots of inverse picobars. I spent the whole day finding out what was going on. The effect that he saw was that after a certain number of TT bar events running the PGS Olympics executable, nothing but muons and not jets, but missing ET appeared in the output. So I finally discovered a situation in PGS where it could overwrite its own code or data. And that was because the list of calorimeter clusters was limited to 50. And 50, I thought, was an unimaginably large number for the number of jets or you know, calorimeter clusters in the detector. But when you have very fine segmentation, and when we change from 0.7 cones to 0.5, there are some events that have 50 calorimeter clusters. So you get to the 51st one, it wasn't protected. It would write into somewhere else in the program. And what it was doing was writing an integer 1 into the memory location that contained the number of calorimeter cells in ADA. A number that should have been 320 suddenly became 1. And it stayed 1 for the rest of the time you ran the program. Needless to say, that had disastrous effects on the object's simulation and reconstruction. So it was in the little chunk of code transcribing the list of KT jets into the cluster list at the end of that code where I neglected to put in a check for the thing. 50 is so huge, you know, who thought? So I changed it to 300. And so the problem is, for whatever reason, I went immediately looked at the LHC Olympics blind samples, and I didn't find any evidence of this effect. And this is still a total mystery to me. Now, it's possible that... Oh, yeah, I'm sure. So if it's not doing this, it's doing something else. Now, if it's overwriting Herwig, that's probably okay. But if it's overwriting, you know, something else, I just don't know. It's the effects are unpredictable. Mea culpa. So I immediately repaired the problem, put a dire warning on the web page, and alerted Jesse and Matt and Herman. You know, big question, why had we not uncovered this? This is such a horrific sort of, you know, violence to do to your program. So are the Olympics files affected? I conclude they must be, but the way to check this is to run the new version of PGS exactly the same way you ran the old one and then check the files. It's possible, barely possible, that they'll be the same. But it's also possible that they won't. Bugs like this, you cannot predict what they'll do. Are there other PGS4 bugs? Well, at this point, there are only unknown ones. There was a small bug found this week in the cluster width calculation. The people don't generally use the cluster width. It's not used in object reconstruction really anywhere, so it was kind of innocuous. But it was repaired yesterday. Jesse found this one. And there were a lot of bugs found in PGS3 in the process of upgrading to PGS4. Those are documented in the README file inside the release. Most of these were pretty harmless or rare. Of course, they're a pain. And my attitude towards this kind of software is keep moving forward. Don't look back. But, okay. I think it's more fruitful at this point to compare what we had in June to what we have now rather than compare what we have now to the old PGS3. And as you can see, well, there might be a slight bug in the electromagnetic calorimeter resolution. Just 2 minutes. Sorry. So also a couple weeks ago, Matt and Kyle found an event in the TT Bar sample just out of the box, like event number 172, with a jet having very large transverse energy and mass, but no tracks. Question to me immediately was, do we expect such things? Here's a plot for TT Bar events at LHC of what the jet mass looks like. It extends out to a TeV, orders of magnitude later. Here's a plot of the ET, similarly extends out to one TeV or so. Here's the plot of those two things against each other. I'm not sure what I expected this to look like, maybe more of a line, but in fact, you can have jets with big mass and small ET, or big ET and smaller mass. Okay, so most of them are down here. What about number of tracks? This event of interest is this one right here. So now here, this number of tracks thing is actually an integer that I've added a little random number to so that you get a nice scatter plot rather than a bunch of vertical lines. But this event landed here. Zero tracks and 700 GeV of mass. I don't know how that happens. Might be a part of this sort of continuum, just an oddball. Might be a signal of something going wrong. Might be a signal that using KT algorithm is not the right thing to do. Might be the implementation of it. We need to dig into this further. How do you get 700 GeV of no charged energy? That's really interesting. So, haven't found it yet, but keep. This is where I kind of cut off at 10 o'clock last night. So, in summary, we have a major new revision of PGS, PGS 4, with enforced object cuts and uniqueness. So, it really standardized the physics objects. Default is KT jet finding, it's more realistic PT resolution for track, more realistic B tagging efficiency, realistic electromagnetic resolution, so we have to check whether the parameter file suffered from some virginitis. There's support now for not just Pythia, but Herwig, AlpGen, other generators that you can write into files, no dependency on the CERN library. So that's really all I prepared today. Thank you, Dee. That's a good question. Our jet collections include the KT algorithm, cone-based algorithm, midpoint, and this is a subject of study and debate. That's what I mean by jet collection. Michael? Well, the thresholds that I showed you were for design luminosity of 10 to the 34th. When we're running at 10 to the 32 or 10 to the 33, there'll be a lot looser thresholds, a lot lower. So the physics, and probably even during a run, as the luminosity decreases, you could imagine changing thresholds or rates. We do that in CDF and D0. Go ahead. The list of generator particles is available inside PGS. So you can always look to see how well you reconstructed your electron direction and momentum and so forth directly. Doing it with quark jets and gluon jets is a little bit trickier. There's no one-to-one association, for example, between a B quark coming out and a bunch of hadrons, at least not in Pythia. Pythia gives you a whole color string. And right. But you could use just the quark itself. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Very easily. It's the standard STD HEP format. So, let's see, Pythia and Herwig are pretty deeply embedded. They come linked with the executable when you do the standard linking. Okay. So when you actually link, you have both Pythia and Herwig present in the same code. AlpGen, I believe the way it was implemented is through an auxiliary file that's then read in. I haven't used it myself. Right. But what they do is they run a separate job, put out events that have been run through Pythia, and then read it into the STD HEP list, bypassing Pythia and Herwig altogether inside the PGS executable. I think that's how it's working, but someone can correct me if I'm wrong. In the what format? Okay. So my page refers to the wiki page and vice versa. So not all the documentation exists on my page, per se. But we could change that. A real user guide would be another goal to put on the list. Thank you.